Well, now, pretty much everybody knows this scripture, right? I mean, we hear it Advent after Advent after Advent. If you don't know it from that, you know it from Handel's Messiah, right? This is a text that comes from the 8th century, before the time of Christ. It begins with a word of hope to a people who had experienced military conquest. If you notice, the Assyrian army has conquered two tribal lands, the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali. They had also conquered some of that land beyond the river that Isaiah talks about. But this is a word of hope that the people who have walked in darkness, in despair, will see a great light. Those who have lived in a land of deep darkness, depression, on them has light already shined. And then the passage goes on to describe a particular individual. Now, this poem was probably originally written as a song to be sung at the coronation of a king. It has that very form of the songs throughout the Middle East that are sung when a king is crowned. And so you have a description of this king who comes to bring a new realm. A child is born, it says to us. And the idea was that when the king was crowned, he was born again as a new figure. In some of those cultures, born again as a god. And then we get a whole series of titles. You know, the Egyptians like to give their kings fancy titles. A whole sequence of fancy titles. And this may be something that the Israelites borrowed from their custom. But all of those names, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, are all titles for the new king. Now, we don't know exactly which king it was. Some suggest Hezekiah, who turned out to be a pretty good king. But when the early followers of Jesus read this passage, and of course they did, it was in their Bible. Remember, there was no New Testament for a long, long time. There was the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. There were the prophets, which includes Isaiah, and there were most of the writings available to them. But the Gospels were still being shared in oral form, as far as we know. Letters were being dictated and circulated, but they weren't collected in a book yet. And so they looked to the Torah and the prophets for their wisdom. And when they read about this particular king, looking through the lens of Jesus, they said, this is who that was about. It must have been about him. Now, Jesus was not a king like Hezekiah was. Jesus was not a king like the Roman emperor was. In fact, he stated boldly to Pilate, look, my kingdom is not anything like you have ever seen in this world. This was a king whose throne was a cross. And at his coronation, the crown that was placed on his head was a crown of thorns. Nevertheless, those early followers looked back and said, this is the one who will usher in a whole new era. This is the Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. And some of them were willing to die for that conviction. When they were presented with the option of Caesar is Lord or Jesus is Lord, they refused to say that Caesar was Lord. And they died for that. But you know, it's hard to be a follower of the Prince of Peace in those hard times. It's pretty easy as long as things are going well. But when your life is at stake, when you're threatened, when you're fearful, it becomes very difficult. And some folks who were followers of Jesus couldn't say that Jesus was Lord. They relented and they said that Caesar was Lord. And there was a big controversy when they wanted to come back into the church. Should they be forgiven when others had died for their convictions? It's difficult to be a follower of the Prince of Peace when things are hard. They had all kinds of good excuses. This is impractical. Jesus' teachings just don't work in the real world. You need to be real in the real world. And then, you know, when things are all peaceful and calm, then you can be a follower of the Prince of Peace. But there were followers who said, no, this is the most important time that we hold on to the teachings of the one who has counseled us, who has shown us God, who has loved us like a parent, who is the Prince of Peace. Still today, we hear those same things, don't we? You can't live the way Jesus taught. It's impractical. You can't love your enemies. You can't turn the other cheek. That's naive. It doesn't work. And we hear that over and over and over and over again. And as long as things go pretty well for us, it's easy to be a follower of the Prince of Peace. But what happens when we feel threatened? What happens when we're afraid? Instead of overcoming evil with good, the temptation is to try to overcome evil with evil. It never works. It just creates more evil. To the argument that Jesus' teachings and even the lives of his early followers are impractical, I would like to present a story. Now, there are lots of other stories I could have told, but I think this one is especially pertinent for today. There was a guy named Sherwood Moran. He was born in 1885 in Covington, Kentucky. His father was in the Army, the Quartermaster Corps. When he got out of the Army, they moved to the Flatbush area of New York City. He went to the Brooklyn Latin School. After he got out of school, he was kind of at loose ends. Didn't know what he wanted to do with his life. He had the gift of gab. He was quick with a story and quick with a joke. He could tap dance, as you tell I can't. He could actually, they say, lift his leg high enough that it was almost like a vertical split. He thought, I know what I can do. I can go into the theater. That's perfect for somebody like me. Until one of his friends said, yeah, but do you really want to be associated with the kind of people you'll meet in the theater? Even as I say that, I'm trying not to take it personally. So instead, he went to work for the YMCA. He traveled around a good bit, and one of the leaders in the YMCA talked him into going to college, talked him into going to a particular college, Oberlin College in Ohio, where he met a congregational minister who served a church there but also taught religion in the college. He became a pacifist. He decided, under the influence of this particular pastor and teacher, that he would attend seminary. And when he did, he attended Union Theological Seminary in New York City. Now, he took a little time out because he was still traveling for the YMCA, helping to set up their programs in various countries around the world. But when he finally graduated from seminary, he was married by that time, he and his spouse thought they were going to India as missionaries. He had arranged with the Congregationalists to be sent to the mission field. At the last minute, instead, he was sent to Japan. They were sent to Japan. He was good with languages, so he learned the language quickly. He loved the culture. He incorporated the culture. He is not exactly like what we think of as a missionary, perhaps, but what he did was to go around Japan creating settlement houses, like Hull House, Jane Addams Hull House in Chicago, or like the settlements in eastern Kentucky, Henderson Settlement, Hindman Settlement, places where people who might not otherwise have their needs met, health care, education, need for community, would be able to have those met. He spent his life creating those places, in a way doing something similar as he had done for the YMCA. He was there for the growing militarism of the Japanese government. He opposed it vocally. After all, he was a pacifist. Once when he saw a Japanese soldier mistreating a Chinese person, he stopped him and shamed him. He said, you say you're a child of the Son, and yet you treat another person like this. He almost lost his life for that. He also loved art. He wrote some monographs on art, and every 7 years, missionaries would get a leave of absence. They'd get a furlough. And he would take his family to Europe to look at the great art museums and the great works of art there. But on furlough during December of 1941, he came back to the United States and was living here when Pearl Harbor was attacked. His colleagues on the mission field were all gathered up and imprisoned in Japan. He was here. He could not go back. He and his family could not return. He did something that most people would consider counterintuitive. This pacifist went to Washington, D.C. and volunteered his services enlisting in the United States Marine Corps. He said, I knew I was probably one of the most fluent Japanese speakers who was not a native of Japan. I knew that that would be useful. And so at the age of 56, they made allowances for folks who were fluent in Japanese. At the age of 56, he became a captain in the Marine Corps. He was sent to the Pacific Theater, wound up at Guadalcanal a couple of years later. One of the bloodiest and most fierce battles in the Pacific. His job was to interview prisoners. He didn't call it interrogation, he called it interview. And as prisoners were brought to him, he had a very particular, and some folks thought peculiar, way of conducting interviews. While some of those who were translator interviewers would make the prisoner stand throughout the whole interview at a rigid attention, Sherwood Moran invited him to sit down. He would ask them if they were being treated well, if they were being fed, if their health care needs were being met, if they were wounded, were they being cared for? If they weren't, he would see that that happened. He would ask them about their home, about places that some of them he knew about their families, about their people. He said, there are two principles if you're going to interview a captive. The first is, no, let me start with the second. The second is to know the language fluently. Now, you'd think that would be the first, wouldn't you? The first one is the attitude of the interviewer. And he made his attitude clear at the beginning of every interview. He would say to the prisoner, since you are no longer a combatant, since you are here as a captive, I don't consider you an enemy anymore. You're simply someone I can talk to. And he treated each one with respect. When one soldier had a severe leg wound, he and the medical personnel saw that that leg wound was addressed, as he puts it, because we genuinely cared that he was cared for, not because we were pretending to care for him to get information. He was the most effective interviewer in the entire Pacific Theater. He was given a Bronze Star and a commendation for his work. And they asked him to write up how he went about interviewing. Because you see, it wasn't just a friendly conversation. He asked serious questions and he got information. But it was in the midst of that respectful conversation that that happened. You see, he had combined practical knowledge, Aesop's understanding that persuasion is better than force, and the lessons he had learned from the Prince of Peace, Jesus Christ, and he had brought those two together as an interviewer, and he was incredibly successful. He wrote a little memo that's remarkably short at the request of his commander to share with other interviewers. He calls it Suggestions for Japanese Translators Based on Work in the Field. It's a remarkable document. It became the standard for interrogation for decades. Why? Because it works. It works. So don't you let anybody tell you that the way of Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace, is naive. Don't let them tell you it's impractical. Don't let you tell them it doesn't work. It's trying to overcome evil with evil. That's impractical. You never find peace that way. If you're looking to find that everlasting peace that Isaiah describes by following the Prince of Peace, we have to go about it in a different way. To come to Christ as a child, we have to take upon ourselves the mind of Christ. The writer of Philippians puts it this way: have this mind among you that was in Christ Jesus, who did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but humbled himself even to death on a cross. That's who we're called to follow. That's what works. That's what creates the conditions for everlasting peace in following the Prince of Peace. And so this season, the question is very similar to the one that Joshua asks the Israelites. Choose this day whom you will serve, the gods of the Egyptians, the gods of those who held you as slaves, or the Lord, the Prince of Peace. As for me and my house, we're going to do our best to serve the wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. I invite you to do the same.